I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
I want to welcome Tommy Graham, the editor of History Ireland, National Magazine. He's a historian in his own right and a lecturer, and he brings these hedge schools to the people. His panel are really the experts in this area. Ladies first, Liz Gillis. I know that Tommy will introduce her in a minute. Liz is a friend of mine as well. Going back a few years ago, I combed Ireland in 2015, trying to get a programme together for the commemoration of 1916. And I would have attended seminars and lectures around Ireland. And international professors were coming to visit and talk. The best I heard was Liz Gillis, by a long way. Martin Mansra, he's a very humble genius, really. He is one of the key people behind the peace process. And a man that a lot of people admire for his humility. A brilliant historian as well. Dolan Fallon is an excellent young historian, works with RTE, as has Liz as well. You'll have seen him recently on TV. Multi-published work. His best work, I think, by far was the work on John McBride. And he has helped students that I have had to complete excellent projects for their Leaving Cert, as has Liz, I must admit. We are expecting another member of the panel, Dr. Mary McAuliffe. I think she's one of the leading experts in the world, really, on women's history, particularly at this period. And she's currently doing new research in that area. We couldn't have got a better panel. We're going to start the proceedings in a minute. I just want to mention to our history teachers that are around the place and particularly invite all the other schools with a large welcome. This wouldn't work without the history teachers from Skerries, Sutton, and the other schools who came here today. Four of those schools wanted to come here today. We couldn't really put them in. Thank you for coming here today and making this a real Dublin Schools event. I want to remember, too, Dr. Pat Callan, who put this programme for Leaving Cert together. He was our assistant principal here for 20 years, and he suffered a bereavement in his family last week, so he's unable to attend today. Okay,
and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. I have to say, in the 10 years of doing these, this is the biggest crowd I've ever sat in front of. So this is our first stadium gig, you could say. Now, the topic this afternoon is a century on. How do we view the War of Independence? And I think Kevin has done an excellent job in introducing the panel. I'd just like to welcome everyone here, first of all, from the Malahide Community School, from Skerries Community School, and from St. Fintan's High School in Sutton. Now, just one or two housekeeping things. I know that the Skerries people have a train to catch. Apparently, there's a two-hour honours maths class. You know, how could you miss that? So I will, in case you're worried that you might miss it, we will wrap up sharply at about 20 minutes past three, okay? Now, the way this is going to work is, you're going to do all the work here, by the way, first of all, and I'm just here to keep order. I will call on the various students by name to ask their question of the panel. I've already nominated somebody to respond. And then the person asking the question has a chance to come back in, you know, at the end saying, rubbish, you didn't answer the question, or whatever, whatever is appropriate. Now, before I forget, I would like to acknowledge the support of the Commemorations Unit of the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht. I would also point out that this is being recorded, so if you fall asleep, you know, it can sometimes happen, you can catch it on our website, on podcast later or tomorrow or whatever. And of course, you know, any comments you make, you know, keep them clean and, you know, non-libelous. Now, let's go to our first question. Robert McCann, 6th year Malahide Community College. Where are you? Now, we have radio mics here. So if you get the radio mic down there, and Robert, if you could just ask your question.
It's on.
Sorry, I just want to say that, by the way, we have a fifth member on this panel. Kevin is actually officially on this panel, but he's taking a floating role here. But I will be pitching the odd question to him as well. Robert. Good microphone technique there.
Do you think that Lloyd George's decision to suppress the Dáil in September 1919 contributed to causing a war of independence? And do you think that independence could have been achieved through dialogue if the Dáil had not been outlawed?
Martin.
Well, it all depended really on the attitude of the British government, and they made it clear long before even the 1918 general election, when Sinn Féin was rising, is, look, it isn't an issue about whether it's a republic or not. Ireland wants to be a sovereign, independent state, and we want to make it clear under no circumstances can we accept or tolerate that. Now, there were some actions earlier in 1919. I suppose the first action of 1919 at Solihull Beg, where two policemen were shot protecting some gelignite being carried. So there were actions. The suppression of the Dáil and suppression of Sinn Féin, which happened pretty much at the same time, they certainly led to an intensification of the War of Independence, but they didn't start it. You see, the view on the British side was this, and indeed amongst Unionists in Ireland, look, they're not going to take their seats at Westminster, so therefore they're going to be totally ineffective, and in a few months' time they'll crawl back, and they weren't going to pay any attention whatsoever to the result of the 1918 general election. Yes, of course, in abstract theory, if people had been willing to listen and respect the result and so on, no doubt perhaps conflict could have been avoided, or if the Allies had been prepared to give a voice to Ireland at the peace conference. But the reality is that nobody at the peace conference, not even the Soviet Union, which had only just been formed, wanted to offend Britain by supporting Ireland. So Ireland had no diplomatic support from any other state.
Now, Robert, do you want to follow up on that? Are you happy with that answer? Anyone else on the panel want to come in on that?
Just on the question of the Dáil, how effective was the Dáil? I mean, the Dáil only ever met four times in public, and the last time it met in public was in May 1919. It's very hard to operate a parliament when you're at war with the most powerful empire in the world. And in total, you know, between the meeting in January 1919 and the truce, the Dáil only meets 21 times ever. But despite the fact they're not able to meet and go about the business of normal politics in that sense, some of what they do around the country is remarkable. Like, they establish republican courts. You know, they tell people, we're done with the British court system, we now have an Irish Republican court. They establish a Republican police. Like, for an underground revolutionary parliament, they do quite well. But I think the main thing about the Dáil, it has a symbolic importance. It's a symbolic representation as much as it's a political body.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. Tom Duffy, Skerries Community School. Tom, where are you? If you take the radio mic.
Hell yeah. I just wonder now, what new evidence has come to light since the 50th anniversary of the War of Independence?
Donal.
So you're the lads that are missing Matts to be here, so I'll speak.
No, they're not missing Matts.
Oh no, Matts is coming.
That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the primary difference, I think, between researching this period now at the removal of a century and trying to research this period, say 20 years after it happened, it's just the sheer volume of first-hand accounts that we have access to. The best resource is the Bureau of Military History. They're just incredible witness statements taken by people who were there at the time. 36,000 pages worth of witness statements from, you know, direct participants in the Irish Revolution. And the problem with the witness statements, there is problems with them. They were taken very late on. I mean, they began taking these things in 1947. I don't know about you, but I mean, I can barely remember what happened 6 months ago. So sitting people down in 1947... and asking them to describe what they'd been through in 1919 or 1920, memory is a very funny thing. But the witness statements are online, bureauofmilitaryhistory.ie. You can search them by keyword. So whatever aspect of the revolution you're interested in, Gaelic Athletic Association, the GAA, you know, you can search Gaelic Games and it'll bring you into every witness statement from around the country that mentions Gaelic Games. That's an absolutely incredible resource to have. The pension statements are more reliable. The witness statements, there's a lot of one-upmanship. People are trying to put themselves at the heart of history. There's seven or eight lads who claim they raised the flag over the GPO. You know, unless they were taking the thing down and raising it again all day long, they can't all be telling the truth. But in the pension statements, you have to get verification. So you have to go off and get a senior officer to say.
Donald, just before you go on to that, just a little technical point, right? Just if you're a student of history, you have to make a distinction between a memoir. A memoir is somebody's, yeah, you know, writing years after the event. Now, it's an honest account, but of what they remember, yeah, or of what they don't remember. It's different than if you get something that was produced in real time from the period.
Absolutely.
So there's different levels of evidence. And if you come up with this in a history essay, you'll get big marks for this, right? you know, I've been able to distinguish between different types, absolutely, of evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, so a memoir is somebody's remembered whatever, and of course it depends.
But he can rely on contemporary records that they have kept.
Mm. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Let's not get too technical here.
So, the pension statements are more, I think they're generally more accurate because you have to go off and get someone to say, he was there, he did this, I saw him do it, or I saw her do it.
And the government was giving you money, right?
So there was money involved, exactly.
There was money involved.
Some people didn't give pension statements. Some people who were angry with the state that emerged from the revolution said, I don't want a pension from this state. I didn't fight for this state. And they never applied for one. First-hand stuff from the time is fantastic. Military archives online have loads of primary sources. So An Toghlach was basically the newspaper of the IRA during the War of Independence. That newspaper is up, digitised entirely. And all this stuff, the Bureau of Military History, the pension statements, the newspapers from the time, it's all free on military archives. And that says something about this country, that we took material as good as that and put it online for free.
Kevin, can I go to you in this as a teacher, right? In your quieter moments, do you kind of quietly curse military archives for producing all this extra work that teachers have to do by trawling through these extra sources?
No, we love the work. it's not burdensome, but in the last couple of years, I was talking to Liz a little bit earlier about this, like the quality of work that history students are producing in Ireland is of a very high standard, particularly the project work, because they really engage with it. I mean, the average mark 2 years ago was 90 out of 100. The average mark in some schools was 97 out of 100. And a lot of it is to do with the sources online. Can I mention too, some of the teachers may be familiar with this, some of them may not. There's on Skullnet or PDST, there is a booklet really, a documents booklet put together by Dr. John Dredge, 1918 to 1923. And I was talking about this event with him at the weekend, and he said he put more work into that than he put into anything because of all the controversies he was hitting, that he couldn't get a handle on them until he found the documents that answered his questions. Now this is a guy at the top of his game, so for these young people doing a Leaving Cert exam facing the kind of controversial issues that come up in the early 1919 to 1921, it's an enormous task for them to get their head around it. I was at a meeting, I think it was 2015, they were making plans in Dublin for the commemoration of 1916, and the historian Joe Lee said, there was a lot of arguments at the table about, well, this is going to bring up a problem, and we can't put their names on the wall together. You know what I'm talking about at Glasnevin. He said, you think this is controversial? Wait till you see what's coming with the Civil War years. So there's a lot of stuff available to teachers and students, but it's the expert handling of it by teachers with the guidance of people like you that make it a very rewarding section of the paper to do. It's probably the best part of the Leaving Cert course, even though there are no real answers, there are more questions.
Well, on the question of the projects, I have to say, as editor of History Ireland, this has been a great source, an easy copy for me, because we've published the winners of this essay competition. Didn't run this year, by the way, but it's going to be back next year, by the way. So, you know, it hasn't gone away. It'll be back next year. And we've published those articles and some brilliant stuff, I have
Absolutely.
To say. And not just the research, but also very readable. You know, yeah. They know how to communicate as well. Mary, you wanted to come in?
Yes, just to say, since the 50th anniversary, one of the big things in this decade of centenaries, of course, is the role of women has become very, very important. And with the military archives, we now have material that we didn't have before to show the role of women and expand our knowledge about what women actually did, whereas they were not just the girls helping the lads fight for Ireland. They actually come into their own in terms of history. And also going back to eyewitness accounts, for example, I've been working recently with Margaret Skinner, who wrote in 1917 her eyewitness account of her week in the Royal College of Surgeons doing my bit for Ireland. Now, it is a propaganda piece. It's about, you know, weren't these guys great and these women great going out to fight for Ireland? But it also gives us detail of what happened that week, of, you know, when they arrived on Stephen's Green and the trenches they dug. She does not mention Countess Markovitch shooting anybody on the green in those first few hours, which again, you know, helps us deal with that controversy that's always generated about Countess Markovitch, that she shot an unarmed Dublin Metropolitan policeman. And so the material we have about women and about the Irish Citizen Army and about the working class who participated in the rising is much more than we ever had 50 years ago. And it's changing how we write the history of the revolution. So history is never static. It changes with the material we have, with the sources we have, with the archives we have. And revolutionary history is transforming because of our access to things like the military pension applications, the Bureau of Military History files. But also because this decade of centenaries has got loads of people interested in history, and it is a very interesting subject, people are coming out and saying, we have this material that's been up in the attic for years, material, first-hand accounts. My great-granny or my grandmother left this, or grandfather left this. So all that material is coming up. Again, going back to Margaret Skinner, I've just finished writing a biography on her. Her great-grandniece has a big suitcase full of photographs from that period, photographs that had never been seen by anyone, and I'm still negotiating with her to try to get
keep
them in the public.
Keep me pumped, Mary, right? I'm always desperate for images for the magazine. Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, a material like that, like recently I found a photograph of the village my mother came from in North Kerry, which was burnt by the Black and Tans, and never seen a photograph of it destroyed, and found it about 2 weeks ago. So there's material out there that nobody's seen for the last 100 years that we're still coming across, and it's changing how we write the history, how we analyse the history, and how we broaden out our knowledge of the history.
Terry, Mary, you've raised the issue of women's history. I'm just going to move on to a question on that from Cliona O'Riordan. Cliona O'Riordan from Skerries Community School. Just get the mic there. Yeah, no, I'll go back to that.
My question is about, at local level, what part the women played in guerrilla warfare tactics used by the IRA?
No, Mary, that's a fairly specific question, right?
At good local question. Level. Yes, and I think local and regional studies are very important in order to really get drilled down into the detail of what was happening in particular parts of the country. Some parts of the country weren't very violent during the War of Independence. Other parts Were more violent. But what were the Cumann na mBan women doing particularly? I presume it's Cumann na mBan you're interested in. Well, if you look at the branches, if you go online in the military archives, you can go into the Cumann na mBan files where you can get membership names at local level. So whatever local community you're from, you can go in and see who's in that branch. And you can also then match that with pension application files and see what the women are saying they're doing. And what you discover is the women were as active as the men in terms of militancy and being combatants in the War of Independence. Any activity that happened, very little happened without them, that any activity that happened, they may have not been the frontline soldiers, but they were delivering arms and ammunition to ambushes. They were the dispatch carriers, so they were taking messages from one commandant or one leader to another. They had the safe houses, they were running the safe houses. They also had set up first aid stations, because, of course, if you were a wounded IRA man and you were on the run, there was no way you could go to a hospital. You had to be dealt with if you were wounded in the field by the Cumann na mBan women. They also, a lot of them looked after the arms dumps, and it is the women who are looking after the arms dumps. Some of them are actually making homemade bombs and ammunition and things like that. Quite dangerous work. Very important part of their work is intelligence gathering. They are living in the communities. So if a town has an RIC barracks or a garrison, a British military garrison, which Black and Tans are stationed, or the auxiliaries, they're watching them. They're watching them coming and going, and they're passing on the information about their activities to the active service units or to the local IRA branch. And then those plans can be made about ambushes. Some of them are setting what we call honey traps, in that they are getting to know the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, and they're getting information out of them. They're spies, basically. And then they're doing what was usually written into the history books. They're, you know, feeding and looking after and washing the clothes and making sure the men on the run have somewhere safe to sleep when they come to the safe houses. They're doing some quite traumatic stuff as well. If young IRA men were shot dead, it is the Cumann na mBan women who retrieve their bodies, clean them, get them ready for burial, and then make sure that they have a proper, both religious and republican burial. Oftentimes, they're the ones who take the guns into the graveyards, so there can be shots over the graveside. But, you know, think about that. They are actually having to prepare for burial young men, usually 17, 18, 20-year-olds, that they knew themselves. So it's quite traumatic. And oftentimes they are roughly treated by the Black and Tans because about late 1920 into 21, the government realised how important the Cumann na mBan women were to a guerrilla war, that they were the eyes and ears of the active service units. So they are they're getting the worst of the reprisals, the attacks on their homes. They're being beaten up. There was a woman in Longford, Ballina Lee Cumann na mBan. She was beaten so badly one night that 9 of her teeth were knocked out of her head. And she said, well, you know, I just got them, went to the dentist and he fixed it up and I continued with my work for Ireland. They're very stoic. They see that as their sacrifice for the cause of Ireland. I would argue that without the Cumann na mBan women, the guerrilla war that the IRA took to the Crown forces could not have been as successful as it was. Like, they did fight them to a standstill, really, when the truce was called. But without the women, they couldn't have done it.
Okay, before I move on to the next question, just to say, if anyone in the audience wants to ask a question or make a contribution, even if, you know, you're not the designated questioner, just put your hand up and we'll go to you, right? So it's open to everybody, just to make that clear. Now, I want to move on to the next question. Josh McCabe of Malahide Community College. Where's Josh?
The IRA flying columns relied heavily on the goodwill of people to hide them. How many of these people do you think genuinely supported the IRA, and how many felt intimidated or threatened into helping them?
That's a good question. So how many supported the IRA? How many were intimidated into supporting them? Liz?
Well, at the start, with the Solo Headbag ambush, the IRA weren't supported by the people. But the response from the authorities quickly rallies the people to support the IRA. If you look at the newspaper reports that talk about the Solo Headbag ambush where the Tourjeet Brae Brigade shot the two policemen, you know, it's they're totally taking them apart. There is no support for this at all. But then you fast forward to the Knocklong rescue. So the lads that had been involved in Solo Headbag, Sean Hogan, he had been arrested. He's been transported by train to Cork, and Dan Breen and Sean Tracy plan his escape. There's a shootout, more policemen are killed, but the response from the military or from the media, from the people, is completely different to what it was in January. So the support had begun to grow thanks to the response from the authorities. Then you bring on the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, and that just brings another level of support for the IRA because of the way the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries acted here and were given a free rein to do it. Depending on some localities as well, though, because in areas like Dundalk, you had a strong British presence there. A lot of British soldiers, ex-British soldiers, lived in the area, so they weren't very supportive of the IRA. And as the war certainly goes on, there would be people that would be intimidated to stay quiet, because the IRA also wouldn't go to houses that, you know, weren't necessarily supportive of them, because it's bringing more hassle on their doorstep. Definitely people would be intimidated to keep their mouth shut. If they see something, don't say anything. And then you pay the ultimate price if you do open your mouth, and that did happen with Mrs. Lindsay down in Cork. So in general, as the war goes on, you're getting more support from the people. I don't have the exact numbers, but again, with the release of the pension files and so on, you are getting those stories now emerging that people were supportive, or else, if not, just to keep their mouths shut, maybe not actively pursuing, you know, to sort of inform on the IRA. Some cases they did, but numbers are, you know, we don't actually have the exact numbers.
How do you measure something like that? I would say one way you could measure public support is in terms of the votes. And sometimes people try and diminish the 1918 election and say, oh, no one who voted in 1918 knew that they were voting for a war. But there was local elections in 1920, by which stage everyone in Ireland knew they were in a war. And the support level for Sinn Féin actually rose. And the percentage of votes that they took around the country went up. So I think if you look at the local elections, there's a lot of emphasis on the general election. But just like today, you had local elections as well. And you see Sinn Féin support rising throughout the war. And I think that's reflective of how the public feel.
And sorry, one more thing. Mary mentioned, or one of you mentioned, the Republican courts. The people actually got behind the Republican courts and totally undermined the judicial system here. So that would be another way to measure the support from the people. Didn't agree with some of the findings if you were the one that was being brought before the Republican courts, because they did try to be fair, but that would be another way to gauge the support.
Yeah, and the IRA did also intimidate people to stay away from the British Army, to isolate them within communities. So they would intimidate businesses not to do business with them, you know, supply them with foodstuffs and all that sort of thing. But also with women, for example, young girls who might be dating or fancy some of the British soldiers or the RIC men were often attacked and had their hair shaved off to stop them. Company keeping, it was called. So that whole process of isolating the soldiers who were living in communities, in garrisons, in communities, but isolating them from those communities and making, you know, creating that there are two groups who are not to have any association with each other, either emotionally or in terms of supplying them or anything like that. So, the IRA does keep a bit of control over what's going on throughout the country.
OK, I'm going to move on to the next question. Dario Reazzi from St. Vincent's High School, Sutton. Now, just if we get the mic over here. Yeah. Who's the closest one? You just pass it along there.
My question was, what was the significance and contribution of the local people and the Catholic Church during the War of Independence?
So there's two questions in one there. Local people, first of all, and then the Catholic Church. Any revolutionary movement has two dimensions to it, I think. It has the army in the field of war, and also, I suppose, the backing of the people. And you need both of those things. You won't succeed without one or the other in a moment of revolutionary turmoil. Ordinary people play a phenomenal role. I don't like that term, ordinary people, everyday people. Play an important role in the Irish revolutionary period. There's numerous examples of this. One that I did a lot of work on, Gaelic Sunday, 1918, where the authorities make it impossible for the GAA to play matches unless they get a permit from their local RIC station or Dublin Castle. You think the GAA were going to do that? They weren't. And the response of the GAA was that they played more than 1,000 games at once right across the island of Ireland. That's an incredible moment of mass civil disobedience that shows ordinary people are involved. The first general strike in Western Europe, the first successful general strike in Western Europe, happens in Ireland in 1918, again, against conscription. The country just stops, you know, with the exception of Belfast, which works twice as hard that day. Nowhere else on the island of Ireland works. They just shut the country down. So, I mean, it's important that Sinn Féin, that the Republican movement more broadly, are able to point at the civilian masses and say, these people are with us. And as the war goes on, there's other examples of it. There's a munitions strike. If you've seen Ken Loach's movie, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, they capture that really well, where the train driver, Liam Cunningham plays a train driver, he refuses to let the British Army or British weapons onto the train. Like, all of this is everyday people who are not members of the IRA, who are taking a very proactive role in the struggle. As for the Catholic Church, I mean, people a century ago were very Catholic, and there's a danger in projecting us onto the past and wishing that they were like us. I mean, Jim Larkin, in the middle of O'Connell Street, Larkin describes himself time and time again as a Catholic communist. Rosie Hackett is a Daily Mass communicant. These people are on the left of the Irish Revolution, and they're still very Catholic in their views. Now, the Catholic Church was a cornerstone of the identity of these people. And in many places, the Church plays a positive role in the Irish Revolutionary period. Like when it comes to the anti-conscription movement in 1918, mm-hmm. and when they're telling people, we're not going off to die in some trench in France or Belgium. The priests are centrally involved in that on the podiums up and down the island of Ireland. The bishops sign the anti-conscription pledge and tell people not to go and fight in the war. So being Catholic was a cornerstone for a lot of these people of their identity. That's not to say everyone in the Irish Revolution was Catholic. I mean, off the top of my head, people like Michael Nowak in Dublin from the Jewish community. There's other examples of that. Whatever faith group you want to pick, you'll find people from Quakers to Jews and everyone in between who played some role in the Irish Revolution. But certainly, I think Catholic identity was important to a lot of that generation.
Yeah. And there's also the kind of co-option of Catholic ceremony in the revolution, in the support of the revolution. So you get mass rosaries being said outside prisons. Mm. You get marches to churches in support of prisoners or in support of local IRA men. You get the militancy of burials of men who were killed in ambushes, IRA men who were killed in ambushes. So basically the local people, the ordinary everyday people, militarize their faith practices in favor of the revolutionary movement during this period as well. And it's very, very effective. Because you, for propaganda's sake, you know, you can't have, and you have to remember, there were international journalists here during this whole period observing what was going on. So a whole, you know, hundreds and hundreds of women on their knees outside of Mountjoy Jail, you know, to rush them, to beat them up, to attack them, would have been terrible propaganda. Yet what they are doing is making a huge statement of support for the revolutionary movement. So it's interesting how the ordinary people use their religion in aid of the revolution.
The only thing I would say is, particularly at the beginning of the War of Independence, you wouldn't have found all Catholic priests in favour. No. I mean, for example, the Solihull Beg ambush was roundly condemned from the pulpit. Now, the priest in question, he'd be a fairly Redmondite politics and had been involved in recruiting and so on. So I think there's a bit of nuance there. But I think the Catholic Church was very important from, the Bishop of Limerick a few weeks after the 1916 executions. But you'd be wrong to think that it was monolithic. I mean, when, as I say, the parish priest of Tipperary quoted the famous saying, where Tipperary leads, Ireland follows. He hoped this wasn't going to be the case, after Solihull Beg.
Liz, yeah.
And just on that, there, as you say, there was condemnation from some in the priesthood and the hierarchy, but you also do have a lot of priests themselves that are victimised. You have Father Griffin, who was actually murdered as the war goes on. Father Michael Flanagan, his work isn't necessarily supported by the hierarchy. They tried to get rid of him. And then you have the Capuchin priests who had attended those the leaders before they were executed in 1916. I think his Father Dominic is arrested and imprisoned during the War of Independence. So you did have some priests that were putting themselves in the front line as well, and some of them, like Father Griffin, paid the ultimate price as well. Mm.
Can I just throw in my own little question here? Is there a sense that this kind of Catholic religiosity that you talk about, Mary, has been used like as a stick in the present secular age to beat the Irish Revolution? You know, I mean, is there a danger of, again, the glib assumption that if they're saying the rosary outside Mountjoy, they're not serious revolutionaries?
Well, I think what Donal said is we can't judge the past by our own attitudes towards religious fervour and religious faith and idea. You know, I think it was, you have to look at it in the context of the time. Everybody was, most people practiced their faith daily and weekly. And it's not to say, again, that every revolutionary was Catholic either. You had women like Kathleen Lynn and Madeleine Vinchmullen, and some of the leaders of Cumann na mBan are Church of Ireland or Anglican or other non-Catholic religions. But they found comfort in their faith. They found comfort in the practice of the faith, particularly as the violence escalated. And I think at a local level, the grassroots members of the Catholic Church and the priests were together, you know, as the violence escalated, they sought comfort from one another. The hierarchy had to play a political game, obviously. They had to kind of walk that line between condemning the violence and radical revolutionaries, but also recognizing that something was changing and transforming here and keeping an eye on where they would succeed, where they'd position themselves to be in power.
And it was a very big change from, say, 60 years previously. Mm-hmm. The Fenians and the Catholic Church were fairly much on all opposite sides, and you know, people like Charles Kickham, the novelist, but also the president of the IRB, had difficulty getting a church funeral and so on. But that had all softened greatly. Mm-hmm. A generation or two later. Now, I mean, I think you will find that there are one or two people in the revolutionary movement, you know, who aren't particularly religious, but undoubtedly it was mutually supportive. And of course, you had a very savvy Archbishop of Dublin at the time, Archbishop Walsh, William Walsh, both from the 1880s through he died in 1921. And I think, you see, the church did not want to become isolated from the people. I mean, originally, it would have been sceptical about home rule, anti-land league, and land war, and so on. And he and Croke and so on tried to make sure that the church was in touch with the people and moved with the people, and he had become disillusioned with the Home Rule Party by the middle of the First World War, even.
Could it just be a case of cynically backing what they considered to be the winner? Or was that the old...
No, I think that's unfair. I think William Walsh was a great clerical statesman. I think they were people of conviction. I don't think they were just sort of cynic. I wouldn't describe either of them as cynics. But, I mean, they weren't totally unworldly either, you know. But, I mean, then few Catholic clergymen are.
If you look at some revolutionary families, you might have somebody, like, if you look at the revolutionary families, like the Ryans, for example, of Tom Cool, you'd have some of the boys are in the IRA, some of the girls are in Comin' Amon, but you also have a nun and a priest in the family. So the Catholic clergy are coming from the same families and the same communities and the same backgrounds as the rebels and the revolutionaries. Divisions are not so wide anymore.
Just as a little diversion, Donal, on your website, the Come Here to Me, which you all should put as your favourites on the top of your computer screens, you have an ongoing series on atheists in the 1911 census.
It's a few of them.
How many of them is there?
Well, I think there's a couple of dozen in Dublin. But Sean McDermott, one of the 1960s...
And their names and addresses, please.
Sean McDermott lists his religion in the 1911 census as Irish nationalist. In marital status, he wrote single, but not for long.
A few of the women wrote in suffragist as their religion in 1911.
Now, I'm going to go on to another question on women's history. Daniel Drummer, Skerries Community School. Where is he?
Hi. My question is on whereabouts in Ireland did women play the most active role, and did they play any sort of critical or leadership roles?
Do I take it there's a little barb in that question? You're looking for evidence of leadership, Mary. Let you interpret that.
Then how do you define leadership? What do you mean by leadership? Yes. Well, it's hard to say where they were most active during the War of Independence. It waxed and waned over the period where the war was being fought and carried out. And of course, the executive is in Dublin. And Dublin is where Comin' Amon is founded in 1914. And the executive remains here, and the executive does govern the whole organisation. But a lot of the branches are also quite independent and left very much to their own devices as the war progresses. So you could say women did play a leadership role. I mean, certainly when it came, for example, to the treaty debates. Comin' Amon are the first organisation to hold a meeting to consider the treaty, And are anti-treaty. They decide not to support the treaty. The minority of Cumann na mBan women who support the treaty leave Cumann na mBan then and found Cumann na Saoirse, which is the pro-treaty organisation. Women like Countess Markovic, who is the president of Cumann na mBan, is Minister for Labour in the first Dáil, and continues on until the treaty debates. Of course, she's anti-treaty, so she withdraws from the government and from the Dáil. Most of the time, she's on the run. So a lot of the Cumann na mBan branches are pretty much left to their own devices, because while there is communication from Dublin to the country, really people are working at local area on their own activities and their own ambushes and whatever they're doing there. So, for example, in Kerry, which I'm studying, you would have local district councils and then branches within that. And so wherever things are happening, you have Cumann na mBan women working with the IRA, with the local flying columns, with the active service units, and doing what they need to do to back up the guerrilla war. I don't know, in terms of leaders, who would you say would the leaders be? Other Markovic?
Well, Countess Markovic, yeah, Minister for Labour.
Yeah.
But in terms of the intelligence war, women are crucial. Yes. Huge intelligence war, and you've got women in really, really high up positions. Lily Mernan is one example. She's actually in Dublin Castle gathering the intelligence, and the authorities became aware that there was a spy in the castle, hadn't a clue it was her. They get the wrong person and they promote her so she's even closer to the information. You've got Josephine O'Donoghue down in Cork, and her with Flory O'Donoghue, they're like a tag team operating the intelligence in Cork City. And you've got Linda Cairns, is crucial to the Sligo IRA, right? Because she had a car. Like, it's difficult that anyone had a car, but for a woman to have a car in 1920 was unheard of. And Vinnie Bourne, who was a member of the squad, when he was asked about what he could remember of Linda Cairns, it was the fact she had a car. That's all that stuck out in his head. But she was transporting three members of the IRA to an ambush, and the British government had brought in the Special Powers Act or whatever, that if you were caught with a gun, then you were liable for execution. And they run into a patrol of auxiliaries. So she took the blame. She said that the guns were hers. Now, somehow the British believed her. They were all put on trial, but the men were not executed. But she got a 10-year prison sentence. So she was crucial to actually ambushes taking place in Sligo. The Cooney sisters, the Aníonna na hÉireann branch of Cumann na mBan in Dublin, their accounts are brilliant. But when it came to Bloody Sunday, after a number of the shootings at Mount Street, they were attending Mass in University Church on Stephen's Green, waiting for the lads who had taken part in the assassinations to then take their guns. The men would walk off and the girls are behind them carrying the guns. So if they did get stopped by the police, the men would be searched, but nothing would be found on them. And so you do have all of those, just some of those examples of what they were doing.
There is one very fine memoir from a woman on the War of Independence, and this is, I think I've got her name right, Kathleen Hayes McCoy. There is a Bridget Bandon.
Cork
was one of the big centres of activity, both in the War of Independence and the Civil War. And it gives you a real understanding. She was the wife of the local commander, but they also ran a business, and the business was being constantly raided by the British. But it gives a very, very vivid account. I don't think it's in print, but it can be got in the library.
One of the interesting things, though, about the women's participation is a lot of their participation was silence was very important to what they did. And indeed, some of them were asked to leave Cumann na mBan so that they wouldn't be suspected by the British, the Crown Forces, in what they were doing. So we don't know a lot of what they did because they had to keep very silent. And that culture of silence remained with them for the rest of their lives. Because, of course, for intelligence work, you need to be able to say nothing about anyone to anyone except the person you're delivering the message to. So a lot of what the women did, Michael Collins worked very, very closely with a lot of women in getting intelligence for all the assassinations and all the different events and ambushes that he was part of planning. So again, I'd go back to the point I made. Without the women, Could the guerrilla war have been conducted in the way that it was? And I would say no, it couldn't.
Daniel, do you want to come back on any of that? You're happy enough with that answer? Very good. Now, next question. Luke Kavanagh, sixth year, Malahide Community School. Where's Luke? Yeah.
How's it going? I was just wondering why there was a disagreement over who should represent Sinn Féin in the 1922 talks in London.
Yeah, in other words, why did Collins go and Dave didn't go? Oh, sorry, the October.
No, the October, the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, or why did...
Well, I think, you know, at that stage, and it isn't much talked about even in the history books, is... You know, there was beginning to be, as you have in a lot of independence movements, beginning to be a bit of a power struggle taking place. Now, it was a question is who should be kept in reserve? Now, Dev's idea of negotiation, and even people like Kissinger would approve of the principle of this, is that you keep your principal person in reserve as somebody who can be, if there's disagreement at the table, somebody that can be referred back to, so you don't have all your resources there having to make up their mind on the spot. Now, I think it's quite possible that Collins, who wouldn't have been a very recognisable public figure up until the time he came to London. I mean, the police had great difficulty getting hold of him during the War of Independence, is that he felt perhaps he should be the person held in reserve. And of course, he was the sort of shadow president of the IRB. There was a kind of shadow organisation. So I think that would be part of it. There was also, interestingly enough, at least according to an interview 30, 40 years ago, is Dev claimed that he wanted Mary McSweeney to be part of the delegation, mm-hmm. and claimed that Collins and Griffith took the view that this was quite unsuitable for women. Now, I've often thought that part of the problem, when you ask yourself, why did so many of the women go, not quite all of them, but most of them, go Republican over the treaty debate, is, well, because they didn't participate in the process of negotiating. If you are kept on the outside, what can you fall back on except principle? Mm-hmm. If you are involved in the negotiation and you have to see what the difficulties are and the compromise, you might have a more nuanced view of what is going on. So I think actually a price was paid for the, you know, by say the pro-treaty Free States Act was by excluding women. And of course the thing only got worse after that. The high watermark was the suffrage. But interesting, even the suffrage, the women lobbied Griffith to have the vote for the 1922 election, but was told no.
They
couldn't have it until the Free State Constitution came into force in December 1922. There was a kind of deep distrust which went on for a long time and stayed in the political system. Hannah Shee Skeffington, for example, claimed that Lammas in the 30s, now not the 60s, had more than once said that he would repeal the vote for women if he could, and sure, couldn't they rely enough on what their male relatives would vote, you know? And I've never seen that denied, and I'm afraid from what I know of Lammas, I don't find it totally implausible.
No, he did bring in the Conditions of Employment Act that excluded women from certain businesses in 1936. And of course, you know, not having the suffrage in 1922 for that treaty election meant that only women over the age of 30 voted. Mm. And of course, most of the Cumann na mBan women were under the age of 30. So they didn't actually have a vote in that election. And that, again, excluded them, as you rightly said, from making proper decisions and feeling marginalised.
Just on the point of the people that we sent to London to debate with the British, I mean, they were revolutionaries. Some of them were parliamentarians or elected MPs. But remember, the First Dáil is a one-party parliament. The Labour Party stepped aside, gave Sinn Féin a clear run at it. So these parliamentarians, these young men who go to London, they may be elected officials, but they've never debated another political party in Parliament. And should the Labour Party have been in the First Dáil, maybe they should have. In the first election in the Irish Free State, the Labour Party got 17 TDs elected. They ran 18 candidates. So I mean, nearly every one of them was elected. So there was a hunger for politics beyond just Sinn Féin in the parliament. So you send these young men across the ocean who've been in a one-party parliament to debate opposite people like Lloyd George, the Welsh wizard, Winston Churchill, you know, Lord Birkenhead. These are the giants of political British political history, and they're debating these members of a one-party parliament. So I think the inexperience, actually, of Sinn Féin on a political level probably showed at that table in London.
Also shows how far British political processes have fallen now when you see who's debating Brexit.
Could I just add something here? Just in terms of the splits that became apparent, because we're going to move on to this area now. Is there a sense that the ambiguity which favoured the revolutionary movement while the struggle was ongoing, you know, against the British, became fatal then when it came to actually make the peace? In other words, the ambiguity over who was in charge, who was in charge of the IRA and so on and so forth, that would have aided the revolutionary movement because the British didn't know, you know, who they were dealing with to some extent. Mm.
But the trouble is about all revolutions is, you know, some of the aims are sort of semi-utopian. You can see this with Brexit, which isn't actually a revolution as such. But at a certain point, if you're going to come to a deal, you have to narrow down the possibilities. You have to make compromises. You have to make choices, and choices that have costs. And that's going to lead to division. Now, Lee Kuan Yew, who was Prime Minister, founder of Singapore in the 1960s, he asked why were there so often splits and civil wars following a successful war of independence. And the reason, he said, is because none of the different factions, none of them had, you know, the authority of tradition, usage, and so on. They were all new. They didn't have a long-established legitimacy, and so on. And so, therefore, inevitably, people would split over their aims, and unfortunately, it came to us. But of course, the third party to the Civil War was the British, because the two sides of the Civil War did try and seek compromise, especially through the draft constitution, but it wasn't sufficiently consistent with the treaty, and Churchill and his right-hand man, who was an ideologue, Lionel Curtis, vetoed it and made sure that the crown was in the constitution with knobs on, and they were absolutely determined that De Valera and Collins weren't get. The reason Lloyd George was considered a genius by the British press and public opinion, at least for a short period, was that he had got the Irish to fight among themselves.
Okay, sorry, is Luke happy enough with those answers? Yeah? Okay, I want to move on to the next question. This is Daniel Fitzgerald, sixth-year Malahide Community School. Daniel, yeah? Did you just get the mic there?
How did the disagreement over the treaty lead to the outbreak of the Civil War in 1922?
Liz, why did the Civil War break out? Give me 2 minutes.
Okay, nice. Well, basically, it's not partition, because the country had been partitioned with the Government of Ireland Act in 1920, so that was set in stone. The pro-treaty sides, or the Irish delegates, recognising that it does copper fasten, but Ireland was going to be split in two. And if you look at the treaty debates, the only people that talk about the North of Ireland are the people who have a connection with the North of Ireland. It doesn't figure in the treaty debates. It's the oath of allegiance that is the straw that breaks the camel's back. That is what everyone is talking about, this oath of allegiance that has to be taken by Irish politicians to the British king. And people didn't fight for that oath. They had taken the oath to the Republic in 1919, but that was the only oath they were going to take. But you do see from my research, I've seen a different approach between the military and the politicians. They're two completely different animals. The politicians on both sides, Arthur Griffith in March 1922, is saying, if we're going to have a civil war, get it over and done with. There was tension brewing in Limerick. De Valera is making speeches left, right and centre, you know, insightful speeches, encouraging people to wade through Irish blood. He is saying this to people, to men who have killed for the Republic before, will kill again for the Republic. The military were trying to stop it. The military are having these meetings, trying to broker peace, to avert conflict, because they know what it is to cross that line. And when you cross that line, there is no going back. you have a sort of the it doesn't help that you have the assassination of Henry Wilson by the IRA in London. That puts pressure on the Irish government to act against the crowd, the anti-treaty IRA that are set up their headquarters in the forecourts. MacReady, who's the commander-in-chief, the British commander, he's telling Churchill to back off. Don't play into the hands. If you attack the IRA that are in the forecourts, it's going to reunite the pro and anti-treaty IRA. There's the Collins de Valera Pact, which if anyone can understand that, I don't know. It's just so confusing. But right up until the 28th of June, there are attempts by the military to stop that conflict. But you have the kidnap of Ginger O'Connell, who was pro-treaty, by members of the anti-treaty IRA, and that really puts it up to Collins that you can't have a pro-treaty army general being kidnapped and just allow it to happen, and then they finally bombard the forecourts. But they had tried to avert civil war. And then when it happens, you have De Valera trying to regain control. He has lost that control of the IRA, the anti-treaty side, and then Griffith, of course, he dies very soon after the civil war breaks out.
This is kind of an off-piste question, not my list. Get in there quick.
I just had a question to jump on the back of the conversation about the treaty negotiations earlier. Do you think it's a possibility that De Valera chose not to lead the treaty negotiations because he didn't want to be credited with a negotiation that he knew they were going to lose and didn't want to be credited with a partition treaty that he felt may have been inevitable?
Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the charge that is made against him. I think that he thought he had a compromise, which we called external association, which was that Ireland would become or stay a member of the British Commonwealth and accept the King as head of that association, but not as King of Ireland. And I think he felt that this could just be pushed over the line. And I believe he thought that genuinely. Now, everybody, when they're acting politically, let's be realistic about it, has mixed motives. They may think one thing at one particular time and think another. The thing is I'm not totally excluding your interpretation. I'm just saying it's not the only interpretation.
And of course, that's precisely what India got after the Second World War.
If
the British had been a bit more subtle.
Yeah, but you see, the thing about that is, and I've written about this, is the British were much more prepared to make allowances for the Indians because the Indians were big and important and all the rest of them prestigious than they were for Ireland being close by. And you see, if you actually look at the detail of it in 1948, 1949, Ireland was invited to go to the Commonwealth Conference. At first it refused, then it accepted, but said we will go not as a member but as associates, you know, according to the De Valera doctrine, and we will raise the question of a partition. And the result is they didn't get an invitation. But, of course, if they had been India, they probably would.
Now, another question over here. Another unscripted question.
I was wondering, you mentioned international press covering the War of Independence earlier. Mm-hmm. Is there any mention or record of foreign military advisors or observers with the IRA during the war?
Yeah, you have the American Commission.
Yeah.
The American Commission and the Labour Commission.
Yeah.
And the American Commission is huge. There's a whole report there on it. There was a big tribunal over in America, Mary McSweeney, Terence McSweeney's wife, Muriel McSweeney. She spoke at this, and it was a huge report. Charlotte Despard, who was the Lord Lieutenant's sister, so he's fighting the IRA and she's supporting the IRA. She's an amazing character. But she's bringing them all around Balbriggan, after the sack of Balbriggan and so on, showing the destruction of what actually was going on in Ireland. And then the Labour Commission in England, they set up their own independent investigation as to what was going on. So not necessarily maybe military people, but certainly politicians or people that would have connections to politicians in America that could help.
Sorry, there's an amusing story. Is there was an assassination attempt on Lord French by, in fact, the Tipperary folks, Tracy and Breen and so on. And Charlotte Despard, who was this Republican sister of the Lord Lieutenant, she reproached Dan Breen with taking a shot at poor John. He was you know, John French, right? And Breen replied briskly to her, well, his only regret was that they didn't get him.
Now, I tell you, guys, I'm just looking at the time here, so if anyone at all on the floor has any questions, just if you just gather your thoughts there. But I have two more questions I want to go to here. Pádraig Burke, fifth year Malahide Community School. Where are you, Pádraig? It's an interesting question.
My question is, how is the War of Independence overshadowed by the Treaty and the Civil War?
That is an excellent question, because this, again, one of these issues that comes up studying history is looking at things retrospectively. Mm. So, Donal.
The danger of kind of reading history backwards, we're always conscious of.
Yeah, but we all know what happens next, you see.
Yeah, we know how it ends, that's the problem. We're kind of back to where we began. So the first question I took was kind of about memory and sources, and this brings us back to that. I mentioned the Bureau of Military History, and the first answer I gave is something you should go and have a look up, look at online. The Bureau of Military History lists its objective as being to tell the story of Ireland between 1913, the formation of the Volunteers, and 1921, the truce. They did not want to talk to people about the Civil War. Now, some people went in, sat down, and spoke about the Civil War, and they continued to record what was said. But specifically, when they took those statements in the 40s, they tried to keep the Civil War outside their brief of what they talked about. The Civil War, more people lose their lives in the Civil War than lose their lives in the Rising and the War of Independence combined. And the incredible bitterness of it is so deep. I mean, one anecdote that captures the horror of the Civil War perfectly, Kevin O'Higgins, who's a government minister, signs the execution papers for a man named Rory O'Connor, who had been best man at his own wedding. I mean, if that doesn't embody the bitterness of that conflict, I don't think anything does. But I don't think that the Civil War has overshadowed the War of Independence. I think for a long, long time, very little was written on the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And in recent times, that's changing. A historian called John Dorney wrote a book recently on the Civil War in Dublin. It's already, I think it's been reprinted already. So that says something about the level of interest in that conflict now. But that centenary is interesting because the 50th anniversary of the Rising in 1966 was a big deal. You know, for the Irish state, it was massive. The troops went down O'Connell Street. People were there in their hundreds of thousands. That was very important. The 50th anniversary of the War of Independence was very important. Monuments went up all over the country. The 50th anniversary of the Civil War was a very quiet event. You know, it was largely uncommemorated by comparison. So I think now the Civil War is more and more coming into our lives, definitely more than it did when it was alive. A living thing.
And that is because it hasn't been written about and researched or studied until the relatively recent past. It was taboo for a long period.
Can I just introduce something here just in a different way, though? Isn't there an assumption, because of the Civil War and because of the partition, and because you had an almost homogeneity Catholic, conservative, kind of rather inward-looking society was established, there was an assumption that this represented a betrayal of the revolution, right? Mm. Whereas, I mean, I've heard Brian Hanley make this point several times that, you know, is that really true? In other words, was the type of conservative society established after independence, was that so far removed from what these people actually stood for in terms of their religiosity and so on?
The prior mentioned Kevin O'Higgins said we're the most conservative people who ever had a successful revolution. Then you take someone like Helena Maloney, who was a member of the Irish Citizen Army. She had this great line years later. She said, we saw a vision of Ireland pure, happy and free. We didn't realise it, but we saw it. Mm. So those two people who go on to lead interesting lives in post-independence Ireland, one of them thinks he got what he was fighting for, and the other one feels that the Republic was never achieved.
You have to look at it from different perspectives. Yes, the middle-class bourgeois did get what they were fighting for. Basically, they got the replacement, the power replacement, a power shift from British authorities to the Catholic bourgeois who become the power mongers in the state. But for women, it didn't deliver anything. In fact, it took things backwards. And Helena Maloney was perfectly right, and she makes several of those statements over the years, in that, you know, she was being asked when she gets disgusted when people ask her why women fought in the War of Independence. You know, would they ask a black-haired man why he fought or a blonde-haired man why he fought? Women could have an ideology to which they were committed. Mm. But of course, the women then do get demonised because of the overwhelming support in Cumann na mBan, not all, but the majority of them, for the Civil War. So they become these unmanageable, ungovernable revolutionaries, these furies, these Amazonian women who had been blooded by this unnatural performance of combat, becoming combatants and being blooded in the War of Independence. So now women need to go back into the domestic and become respectable Irish women, which the Irish Free State sees is necessary for its own identity creation. So for women, the Free State delivered nothing of the promise of 1916.
This is for of course, the radical women. But let's not kid ourselves. A Home Rule Ireland, I mean, the Irish Parliamentary Party was socially conservative. For example, they opposed... apart from the suffrage, they opposed an amendment to the Industrial Act, which would have required the Magdalen laundries to be inspected. And mm-hmm. they said, there's no scandal there. There couldn't possibly be any scandal. And in any case, the managers tell us that they couldn't really run these institutions if they were subject to ordinary. Well, indeed. There's a pre-revolutionary and a post-revolutionary continuity which we shouldn't dismiss. And de Tocqueville said the same thing about the French Revolution. You know, when all the turmoil and tumult was over, there was still a lot of underlying continuity, not just change.
Okay, I'm going to go for our final question. This is to Jessica Conway. And by the way, this gets the prize for the best question on the list, if there is a prize. Jessica, where are you? Yeah.
100 years on, how is the War of Independence still affecting life in Ireland today?
Liz, you want to take... I'm going to throw this into all the panel here to finish up.
How it's affecting... Well, it's affecting hugely the partition. The island is still partitioned. Brexit is a huge thing, you know. This all goes back to the revolution. In terms of what I think is really a beneficial impact is that we as a country are starting to understand how our country came into existence because of this. It is, I feel that we have the country today because of that conflict. I don't actually think we could have had an independent state without that conflict, because unfortunately the British government, as they have done throughout history, promised one thing but deliver something completely different. And I'm just very, very thankful that I'm able to talk about these events and remember this thing, because it is how our state came into being.
Don't know.
What are we now? We're 6 years into the decade of centenaries. And if we've learned anything so far, I think we've learned that commemoration is not really about the past, it's about the present. You know, and history is very important in terms of identity, how we see ourselves. Often, you know, we follow the same football teams our parents followed, we joined the same clubs. We're always shaped by the past in terms of how we see ourselves. And I think this decade of centenaries, the War of Independence and the events around it, has been very important in shaping us. I think there's been a lot of real engagement of civic pride in the decade of centenaries, which is fantastic. More people took part in Gaelic Sunday 2018 than took part in Gaelic Sunday 1918. You know, so there's been a real community engagement in this in recent years that I think is fantastic. I think in terms of how we see ourselves, I think this is a very, very important thing this time.
I'll go to Mary next, since I'll leave you last word, Mark. Mary, yeah.
I think it's been a marvellous revisiting of, for everybody, not just historians, of 100 years ago, and again, the formation of the state and how our state came into being, and how different groups were part of that, like the working class, like women, various other, you know, local communities, what was happening then, and for Irish people. And I think in this very modern world where history is almost couched in terms of fake news, and not understanding our history can lead us down blind alleyways, as we can see in Brexit, which I think is just a post-imperial nervous breakdown in many ways. Like the British don't understand how imperial history is not brilliant and fantastic and amazing and something that they would want back. We have a more intimate understanding of our history. That isn't to say everybody does, but I think we as a nation are engaging with our history in a way that helps us understand ourselves today, how we came into being, how our society has developed, the reasons why we've had to have things, like, say, a second wave feminist movement, because the first wave didn't work and we had to go at it again, why certain groups in society are still marginalised because 100 years later we haven't still dealt with, say the travelling community. They were never part of that revolution in many ways, or you know, the women who were in the Magdalen laundries were not the women they were trying to free 100 years ago. Not even the suffrage women talked about those women. So there were marginalised communities then, and there still are today. And so we can learn lessons from studying history of how we not make the same mistakes again, or not do that again, or correct those actions. And I think it's just an amazing decade that we have this opportunity to look back and to reevaluate and rethink our histories.
Could I go back to Jessica there? Where is she? Do you want to add anything else in here before I go to Martin to wrap up? Has your question been answered, or have you a view on this yourself?
I look at the sort of the War of Independence as quite a huge part of our identity, and personally, I think it's had quite a big sort of social impact on us today. Is like a lot of people in Ireland have an immense amount of pride in their country, and I think it stems from that spirit of like revolution that comes from with the War of Independence, and that we as a nation have managed through guerrilla warfare to overthrow such a massive imperial power. And I mean, that's my personal opinion, and I found your answers also quite insightful. So, yeah.
Martin, do you want to finish up for us?
Yeah. I mean, without being any way, and I don't think we are being any way uncritical of the way things are today, nor are our historians totally uncritical, far from it, of things that happened then. I think, nonetheless, there is a lot of pride in the fact that we managed to achieve independence against the odds 100 years ago and sustain it through many different challenges since. I once said on the platform is, in this country, every generation is going to have to fight for independence, though it will be done in a different way from the way it had to be done 100 years ago. If I've sort of one caveat, it is that the militaristic tradition, and in 1922, on both sides of the treaty divide, the military took over for a while from the politicians. That hasn't, unfortunately, as we saw in the last 24 hours on the border, hasn't died out completely. And of course, Brexit, I think, has reinforced the fact that whatever problems it causes, that we're glad that we are not part of the United Kingdom that is in the process of Brexit. And it has also highlighted the huge difficulties, abstracting altogether from security issues, it is the difficulties of the border. I mean, all our European partners understand, many of them have visited, unlike British politicians, have visited the border. I mean, it runs through communities, dioceses. It's a totally different order of border from, say, the one in Cyprus, which has the Turkish community on one side, the Greek community on the other side. The populations are intermingled, and it is nearly impossible to police, which is the reason why we are clinging on so hard to the backstop, and it's why we're getting so much support from our European partners for doing so. But that is actually something that has sort of the ball in a way has come home to roost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to have to wrap up there because I can see a double maths class hoving into view here for some of you. It just falls to me to thank everybody. First of all, thank Kevin Manning. Kevin, you should definitely be a promoter, right, to get a title like this. And I'd like to thank our panel, Mary McAuliffe, Martin Manser, Donald Fallon, and Liz Gillis. And I'd also like to thank you, all you people in the audience, especially those people who ask questions, scripted and unscripted. And we certainly will be repeating this exercise again. And any of your friends who missed it, you can tell them that this will be on our website shortly as a podcast. So listen, thanks very much, guys, and I hope to see you soon. Very good. Excellent.
Really enjoyed that.